From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai. Three news conferences in 3 days. He's not in office yet, but President-elect Barack Obama has taken his pledge to repair the ailing economy directly to the public, announcing a series of names for his incoming economic team. He has also rolled out a stimulus proposal to, as he said, jolt the economy back to health. But will any of this work? And are the people he is putting in place the right people to get the job done? Furthermore, can the economy wait until Inauguration Day, or do changes need to be made right now? We turn to two Beltway veterans to get their views. Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. Nice to have both of you back.
Hey there, Tony.
Hello, Tony. We're tightening our belts here.
That's a good thing to do, Robert. There's so much to talk about. Let's begin with this. President-elect Obama announcing today that he is creating a new economic recovery board to be led by former Fed Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker. Now, the board is composed of people from different backgrounds outside of government in order to, he says, provide a fresh perspective for his incoming administration.
Let me speak to why I think this is necessary. Yeah, the reality is that sometimes policymaking in Washington can become a little bit too ingrown, a little bit too insular. The walls of the echo chamber can sometimes keep out fresh voices and new ways of thinking. You start engaging in groupthink, and those who serve in Washington don't always have a ground-level sense of which programs and policies are working for people and businesses and which aren't.
So, Mary, Robert, Mary, you first. What do we make of this?
Well, I hope everything that he's proposing works, because the country needs to have something work for the economy. But I'm very skeptical about the whole enterprise, and I don't know what else to propose. The reason why I'm skeptical: one, the team of people he appointed to the posts in the federal government, Treasury Department, White House Economic Council, and so on, are the return of Robert Rubin, basically, from the Clinton administration. The ties are all there. They are what the economics profession would say is the best and the brightest, but they were all part of creating the debacle over the mortgage crisis and the derivatives that caused the problem in the first place. Secondly, the new advisory board that he appointed, chaired by Paul Volcker, it's unclear to me how they're going to relate to him and to the people he appointed, but Paul Volcker is hardly a new, fresh voice coming to Washington to try to tell people what to do. I mean, he served Republican and Democratic presidents. He's a fine man. But these are hardly new voices. Also, I think that people in Washington, including the Congress, know how the people out there feel about the programs, because they represent them and they're elected by them and they go out and talk to them all the time. And many of the programs were put into place because constituents out there ask for them. Well, so I think that's all unrealistic, but I understand why he's doing it. He's trying to do everything he can to inspire confidence.
Well, let me bring Robert in. We're going to talk more specifically about some of the people that he is naming to be part of his new team in a moment, but I'd like to get you to focus in particularly on this recovery board and what you think its impact will or will not be.
Well,
Robert.
Well, Tony, two things. First and foremost, I find it very ironic that the president-elect is doing this so early. Here's why. It's because he said, and I'm quoting him, he said, you know, we need fresh ideas. We need a new way of thinking. But this is typically what a president says after 2 or 3 or 4 years in office, when, in fact, they have become isolated in the bubble. This is a president-elect that is not even president yet, but he's still saying that we need new voices. You would think that his new administration as a whole would be a new voice and a fresh face. Second thing, this is a new idea an old idea with new faces. President Eisenhower actually did the same exact thing back in the 1950s. In fact, he did it with some foreign policy experts. President-elect Obama is trying to have his cake and eat it, too. He's trying to put a very traditional Secretary of the Treasury in place, but also trying to counterbalance that with these new quote-unquote faces.
Let's talk about this unusual transition for a moment from President Bush to President-elect Obama. To follow your point, Robert, how do you see the role both men are playing here? Is Mr. Obama, in fact, taking the responsibility for the economic crisis away from the president, from President Bush, too soon or not soon enough?
Well, he's taking the responsibility away from the current president, lowercase r. In other words, he's not assuming responsibility, saying this is not my fault. However, you know, bold situations mean bold actions. And so what the president-elect is doing is that he's inserting himself. You know, one of the books that he's just finished reading was a book on FDR's first 100 days. And one of the things that Franklin Roosevelt was often criticized on was not being aggressive enough during the transition when President Hoover was in office and we were in a deep, deep economic mess, obviously the Depression. And so what President-elect Obama is trying to do is says, you know what, this president, meaning President Bush, is somewhat disengaged. He obviously is on his way out the door. I need to be a little bit more assertive here to restore confidence. And the main reason why is because all throughout the campaign trail, I said that I would bring some type of stability to the Oval Office when it came to overall fiscal policy. So that's what he's trying to do.
Well, what do you think?
He's trying to do that, Tony. But I think that whether it is successful or not, or perceived as successful, are too getting involved too soon will depend on how these policies that he has proposed in the last few days, along with the people, how they work out in stimulating a recovery once he's in office, because none of the policies are actually going to be implemented or even approved by Congress until after he's in office.
Well, what do you,
so we'll
what
have
do
to see
what
how
do
it
you
works
imagine,
out.
What do you imagine, Mary, the conversations are like right now between Bush and Obama, particularly around this issue?
I think that they are warm and friendly, cordial. And I think that Bush obviously can't keep Obama from announcing anything he feels like announcing. People can announce anything they want. He can simply tell him, as he's already said, he doesn't want to support the stimulus package, what he does not support. But I think that these are very tough times, and I don't see any sign that Bush is even worried or bothered about Obama saying something or saying that he shouldn't be. And so I think it's probably cordial.
Tony, can I speak to that for one moment?
Yeah, please.
Very quickly, I'll tell you what the Obama folks are telling me. They're saying, unbelievable how this president and his staff is bending over backwards to make this transition work. They're returning our phone calls in a very timely fashion. They're overly cordial. They're being extremely professional about this. The Bush folks have told me, you know, it's interesting how the Obama staffers campaign about, you know, hating this president and, you know, this is, we can't afford eight more years of the same in a whole nine yards. However, they've been overly deferential to the Bush administration over and to the overall staff. So I just find it very ironic that the campaign rhetoric has now been deflated. And now the president-elect and his staff now understand they now have the burden of governing, and they're tempering their remarks.
But everything that was said during the campaign by everybody, as always with campaigns, is rhetoric.
It gets changed when
yes,
when the rubber hits
right,
the road.
It doesn't have anything to do with...
Well, you know what, Robert? You said something interesting. I want to follow it up with you because I had written a note for our conversation, and the note says this, Bush is being cooperative, all right? That's the declarative sentence. Mm-hmm. But the question was, does he have a choice?
Yes, he does have a choice. He doesn't have to be cooperative. Look, he is still the president constitutionally. And the office of the president, like, besides all of this grandeur and this, the office of the president-elect sign and the flags and so forth that Mr. Obama has around him, that means nothing on paper when it comes to the overall governing of this country. We have one president at a time, and this president can choose not to return President-elect Obama's phone calls. This president can choose not to consult this president-elect when it comes to fiscal policy, but he's choosing not to do that. And kudos to President Bush for believing that he should be putting the country first and not his partisan
interests. But the thing that you guys are missing is that no matter how cordial they are, when the rubber really, as someone said, meets the road, on the policy proposals that Obama and the Democrats were pushing for the interim session when they came back, the stimulus, Mr. Bush said no. And it didn't go anywhere. So he hasn't, Mr. Bush has not changed his policies or his direction or shifted. What he's doing is we're talking about the relationships between the two staffs and the people who are involved. And given the circumstances the country is in, it makes sense to be cordial, but that doesn't mean shifting your policy positions. But Tony, are we going to ask about the actual policies that have been proposed?
That was my next question. As a matter of fact, I wanted to talk specifically about the $600 billion in mortgage-backed assets from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and whether or not this is something that is workable and doable. Since you brought it up, Mary, is it?
All right. I have 3 points that I've got to make about these proposals. First of all, the mortgage loan, the student loans, the consumer loans, all of those proposals are putting the cart before the horse. There may be good proposals, and they may work in the end, but unless people believe that they will have a job tomorrow and that they will continue to have jobs. His jobs proposals, Mr. Obama's jobs proposals in the Congress, are more important than the loan proposals. Most people don't take out a loan to buy a new car if they're not sure they're not going to have a job 2 months from now. So that's backwards. And then there's another point about these proposals. These proposals remind me in a way of what happened in New Orleans after the levees broke and since then. Every new proposal that's made down there is about going forward, starting all over again, making something new. But all the people who were harmed by the process, no one is doing very much for them. The people who have had foreclosures, who now are even still paying on houses that they're not in or they owe money on them. None of the proposals that were part of the original bailout to take over these toxic mortgages, as it were, and rework them. We've shifted away from that, and now we're trying to make people take on more debt because economists say recovery has to be consumer-driven. And the way to do that is to make the banks and make everybody make loans and have the loans back. But I still think that unless people believe that they will have a job, that it's unlikely that they will go out and make all these loans and start buying up things all over the place. I may be wrong.
Now, I know that Robert Traynor is going to want to respond to that. But
yes.
What we're going to do, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to ask you to hold your thought, Robert. I'm going to come back to you right after we take this break and continue this conversation about what's taking place inside the Beltway. We'll be right back. This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox. We're back talking about politics with Robert Traynham, the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network CN8, and Mary Frances Berry, Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. All right, folks, we were talking about the specifics, as such as they are, of the Obama plan to stimulate the economy. Robert Traynham, your turn to jump in on that.
The answer is, Tony, we don't know. And I don't think Senator Obama, President-elect Obama, knows exactly if this stimulus plan will work. You know, FDR said during the 1930s is that we have to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. It's called the bold exploration of we don't know. And what President-elect Obama is trying to do first and foremost, and this is the underpinning of our fiscal underpinning, if you will, it is faith. We have to have faith in our overall economic system. And right now, we don't have faith, or at least people don't have faith in the banks and so forth. And so it causes a domino effect. It's all psychological. If you take a look at Citigroup, this is a major, major global enterprise that operates in 150 companies. 2 months ago, Tony, solidly sound.
Yes,
everything
sir.
Was fine with Citibank.
Right.
And then we woke up on Monday morning to find that the government had to bail them out as well. Why? It's because their stock market or their stock price went to $5 or low. And the reason why is because a lot of short-term folks out there, short-term traders, said, you know what? I don't know if Citibank is going to make it. I'm going to sell. So again, it's all psychological. And so what President-elect Obama is trying to do is he's trying to instill confidence in the system by these bold, I would make the argument, very, very liberal, very, very expensive programs, but who knows? Maybe they'll work.
Well, you know, you mentioned faith. Well, let me go to another point because I want to get this in before we run out, and that's this. You talked about faith and confidence, and part of it has to do with who the president-elect has chosen to surround himself with. Today we know he picked Robert Gates to continue on as defense secretary. But besides Gates, the latest reports say that Obama wants to nominate New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson for Commerce, Tom Daschle for Health and Human Services, and, of course, Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State. Rahm Emanuel is going to be his White House Chief of Staff. There's not a new face in that bunch. So here's the question. The president-elect was asked about some of those appointments at today's press conference, and he defended his choices this way.
What we are going to do is combine experience with fresh thinking. But understand where the vision for change comes from first and foremost. It comes from me.
So do these choices, Mary, do they give you confidence and faith?
Well, most of those people have been around, and I know some of them, and I like them. So I'm not going to say really bad things about them as people, and they mean well, but the change mantra during the campaign was just about the campaign. Now it's become urgent because of the economic crisis. So the whole group of people that he appointed to the economic posts, as I said, they're Rubin people, Robert Rubin, And they all believe in deregulation. They helped to deregulate the financial sector, which created the problem that we have. The other people seem to be, you know, fairly competent. But our major problem that we have right now is the economic one. So I would focus on that. What Mr. Obama needs is to re-regulate the economy, just as Franklin Roosevelt not only threw everything at the wall, which needs to be done, but he also regulated the economy. And the people that Mr. Obama has selected unregulated it, which left the greed to go rampant in the land. So I want to see what they say about this. And if they don't have any fresh thinking on this, I guess all the fresh thinking has to come from Mr. Obama. And I'm not sure that he can be the fresh thinker on every issue that comes up.
That's an interesting point. What do you say, Robert?
Well, Tony, if you take a look at some of the quote-unquote old faces that Senator or President-elect Obama has nominated, it's roughly about 150 years worth of Washington experience. And so I'm not sure if that's changed or not. To me, it doesn't seem that way. Take a look at their records. And, I agree with Mary. Some of these folks I know as well, and I love them as people. But when you take a look at them as politicians, you have to scratch your head and say, why? Why would you nominate this person when this person has been a Senate Majority Leader for 7 or 8 years and screwed some things up there, presumably? Why would you nominate someone who's been a U.S. congressman from New Mexico and ran for president twice and so forth and so on?
Well, let me play the devil's advocate and give you two words to answer that. Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter came in with a whole new team of
Washington outsiders, and look what happened to him.
Tony, I was in the Carter administration, and I saw what happened, and you're right, and he did have outsiders on his staff, his White House staff, and he knows himself that there were a lot of, as they say, mistakes made. But I would say that Obama picked these people because they are the Democrats you would pick. The last Democratic administration was a Clinton administration for two terms, so there were people who got experience at that time. And so you pick from the people who are your party's people who have experience. And they happen to be the ones.
Yeah, but if I can counter this for 1 second, not to cut Mary off, but look, Bill Clinton came in 19...
cut me off.
I'm sorry. Bill Clinton came in 1992 with folks like Dede Myers and you go on, Alice Rivlin, you go on down the list. These are folks that obviously came out of the Clinton or the Carter administration as well, but they were different faces and they were young faces and they were just a quote-unquote change-type voices. President-elect Obama still has that capability if, in fact, he wants to. You don't have to go to the Clinton administration or to the Carter administration to find new faces. I would dare to say that there are Democratic thinking out there that is fresh and it's different, that may not, quote-unquote, have the experience, but they certainly have the intellect and the gravitas to be able to run this government. So don't tell me.
Yeah, but here's the situation. Do we have the luxury of having the time to deal with that? Don't we have people who can hit the ground, running?
Tony, he has a lot of new faces on his White House staff, people who have not been in government before, people who have been with him during the campaign or in the Senate, who are there.
Not in senior
and
positions.
So
yeah,
the
positions we're hearing about are not those people.
Right. But they're there. And he has still some more space to put some more people in. I'd be interested to see who he puts in to run education, for example, which is crucial to this new economic recovery.
Well, let me,
he's making a mixture.
Let me ask the both of you, if you were to give him a grade, him being Barack Obama, on his transition team selections to date, 1 to 10, 10 being great, 1 being not so great, obviously. What grade would you give him, Robert?
I would give him a 6.
6, that's not too bad. What would you say, Mary?
I'd give him an 8.
An 8. So you have a little more faith that the people that he has put in place, although some of them you don't personally care for, you think they can do the job.
No, I personally care for them. I just wonder about the...
Look, Tony, the point is, are they qualified? Absolutely. Are they change agents? Absolutely not. I mean, that's the point. I mean, you know, look, they're very qualified. They will hit the job running. They will do their job and probably do it very, very well. Mm-hmm. But the point is, if this is a change, or if this was a change election, and if, in fact, Senator Obama campaigned on the whole mantra of, you know what, no more the same, the whole nine yards, we need a clean house, that's not his message right now.
All right, we'll have to wait and see. Time has run out for us, unfortunately. Great conversation, though. I really do appreciate it. Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CNN, CN8. They both joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Thanks, guys. Okay. This is News at Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farad today. And now on to our bloggers roundtable. A fundamentalist Christian university apologizes for its racist past. Should the apology be accepted? And a young black man commits suicide during a live streaming webcast. Should viewers have done more to stop the death? And what does this say about the cyber community? To deconstruct the latest headlines in the blogosphere, we are joined now by writer Amani Channel, who blogs at My Urban Report. Media consultant Carmen Dixon, she writes the blog All About Race and also blogs for AOL Black Voices. And Michael Fontroy, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. He blogs at michaelfontroy.com. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start with this. Bob Jones' apology. Carmen, I see you smiling because you're right here in the studio with me. Bob Jones University apologizing for its past racist policies. The private fundamentalist Christian school did not allow interracial dating until 2000 and banned black students from attending until 1971. The statement that they posted on the web says, quote, "We fail to accurately represent the Lord and to fulfill the commandment to love others as ourselves," end quote. So, Carmen, why this epiphany now for Bob Jones?
Well, a couple of things. I think the epiphany is probably they are, again, looking at culture and cultural signals and realizing that they're out of step with the way the country's moving. And particularly, I don't know the specifics of their recruiting efforts, but I can imagine that they would want to recruit as diverse a possible school body, as diverse a school body as possible. And they even mentioned on their website that they were getting constant questions about their race policies.
But they had to know they were out of step in 1999, 1995, 1992.
But it may not have hit the bottom line. But all that said, I just want to say I think it's great. I think it's a great step in the right direction. I particularly appreciate that they use scripture to back up their apology. They use scripture to enforce the idea that we are all God's creatures and that they were wrong.
And you like that?
I like that very much.
Amani, what do you say?
Well, I guess the school administration missed the memo that the Supreme Court struck down any bans on interracial marriage back in 1967. So it seems that they were very backwards in their thinking until, 2000. This probably is a public relations effort to, as was just mentioned, get folks to I guess, forgive the school and then also to understand that they're moving forward. They're trying to move forward and that they're not stuck in their past. I think it's a good move, though. Anytime you admit your mistakes and try to reconcile is a good thing.
Okay, somebody answer that phone. Okay, good.
My bad.
Okay. We're going to do a segment about telephones because it always happens.
Always.
Michael, what are you – was that your phone, Michael?
No, it wasn't.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, so let's have you chime in.
I just want that to be known.
Okay, you're off the hook about
Thank
that.
Thank you.
What's your take on this?
Well, I have to tell you, I think that this statement and the policy or rather the acknowledgement of the school's history reflects the reality that the arc of history is turning away from some of the ridiculous race-based rules and mores that this country has held dear for so long. It should be noted that the person in charge now is Stephen Jones. And I think he lived through and grew up through some of these controversies going back 30 some odd years. And I think he wants to take the school in a less controversial direction. And so I think we have that to thank for the statement. That is to say, Stephen Jones's evolution as an individual, I suspect. And then also, there is a reality that the country is changing demographically. You know, the Census Bureau has projected that by 2042, the United States will no longer be a majority white institution. So if Bob Jones University wants to remain viable in terms of recruiting Christian conservative students, then it's going to have to look outside of students that look like the history of those who've gone to the institution.
And I suppose if they look toward the White House, they will see that the President of the United States comes from a biracial relationship. All right, let's move on to another topic. Black stereotypes, as a matter of fact, the first African-American, as we have just indicated, heading to the White House. Some are saying that with Barack Obama in the White House, it is beginning to chip away at black male stereotypes. Writer Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote recently in an essay for the Time magazine that the most famous black man in America, here's his quote, isn't clutching a microphone or dribbling a ball. He has no prison record and he has not built a career on four-letter words, end quote. Now, here's a clip I want to play for you. We'll get your reaction afterwards. Cal Reary is the name of the person. He is a black high school teacher, and he talked about how he felt he might be seen differently these days post-Obama.
Maybe I'm imagining it, but I feel like now sometimes when I'm on my way to work, the people who I pass mostly in my car are white. And sometimes I wonder, what are they thinking when they see me? Do they think that I'm pulling out in front of their car because now I think that I can get away with it? Or are they realizing I'm just a jerk when I drive? I'm hoping that I'm not adding to any anxiety they might be feeling since where I live basically voted for McCain.
So, Michael, are people looking at you differently now?
No. I have to tell you, Tony, I'm fearful that people are reading far too much into this election. You know, the stereotypes that have been attached to me by others and other people who look like me cannot be undone because of one election. They took years and decades and centuries to establish, and I just don't think that the election of one person can change that. Now, certainly we're moving in a different direction, but we're also in that afterglow of the election. And you know, if the economy continues to get worse and we see stories as we get deeper into the holiday season of more people getting robbed for Christmas gifts, then maybe those changes that we profess to be hearing from people like we just heard on that clip won't really be the changes we're hearing.
What do you say, Imani?
Well, I think that Obama has done a great thing for folks who are looking for a role model in terms of academic success, political success. In terms of stereotypes, you know, there's no one person who's going to eliminate the years and years of you know, race-based assumptions that people make just because of your color, just because you look a certain way. But for those who may be looking for, you know, we haven't had a leader like Martin Luther King until probably Obama. So for those who are looking for a positive role model, I'd say, yeah, Obama is probably going to help out in that means. You know, for myself, my father always raised me to do your best in school and everything you do. And so if other people ascribe to that philosophy, I think that everyone will have a positive role model, not just black males, but everyone.
Well, you know, I'm going to ask Carmen to talk about this in just a second, but let me just say something that I have observed. Going back a decade when the O.J. Simpson verdict came in, I was going into a restaurant, and the anger that white people had towards me as a black male that day was palpable. Now, since Obama has won, I've had people come up to me in the hallway, Obama, Obama, Obama. White people are just, they're talking in ways that they were not doing before the election. So let's take a break first, Carmen. I'm going to come back. You're not a male, but I'd like to get your perspective on this, whether there's really anything to it. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll continue with the Bloggers Roundtable in just a moment.
Our guidance.
I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. We're back with our Bloggers Roundtable with writer Imani Channel, who blogs at My Urban Report, Michael Fontroy blogs at michaelfontroy.com, and Carmen Dixon blogs at All About Race. So, Carmen, what are you thinking? What are you feeling? Are you having a sense of an easing of the stereotype by people who see you now that Barack Obama's headed to the White House?
I don't know if it's an easing of the stereotype, but there's two things I'm noticing profoundly. The first one is I certainly have had more neighbors smile and say hi to me since the election. That is, it's completely true. It's quantifiable. It's completely true. And I, in turn, say hello back. There is an easiness, at least in my neighborhood, which is a very liberal, you know, West Side neighborhood in Los Angeles. But the other thing that I'm noticing, and it was really interesting, encapsulated in a report that Michelle Norris actually did, a man on the street interview of black men. And they were saying, to the person, they were saying, We got to do better. He's an inspiration to us. We can show our teenage boys that they can do anything if they set their mind to it. We got to stop sagging with the jeans. And I thought that was fascinating. I've actually seen that. I can't cite the blogs, but I've actually seen blog posts similar. So I would say about the stereotype, of course, one even great achievement can't obliterate all the stereotypes. But I do think it expands the perception not only that the majority culture has about black people, but that we have about ourselves.
Interesting. We'll have to keep our eye on that. We have another topic that's not a very positive one to talk about, but it's an important one, and it's this. A very sad and disturbing story out of Florida. A 19-year-old Broward College student had posted thousands of messages online. Some were about his depression and feelings of suicide. And then last week, Abraham Biggs posted a suicide note along with a list of the drug cocktail he planned to use to kill himself. The young African-American took the pills in front of a live webcam, laid down on his bed, and stopped breathing. It is estimated that around 200 people watched this young man kill himself, many of them egging him on. Amani, what does this say? Does it show a possible troubling future for the way people are interacting online?
Well, it shows a troubling trend, at least with this one community where he called the folks his family. He said they had become like a family to me. So, I mean, if you're going to think that about any online community, if I were to post a note that said I'm thinking negative thoughts about, you know, ending my life, I would hope that, you know, the folks don't encourage me to take that step. Of course, our thoughts have to go out to Mr. Biggs' family. But it also speaks to something that isn't often discussed, and that's just the black suicide rates among young males. I was reading one statistic that said that black males are 7 times as likely to commit suicide compared to black women, and that it's the third leading cause of death among young black men. So, you know, this will bring some attention to this troubling problem. But in terms of the online community that egged him on, I mean, just shame on all those folks who didn't. I mean, I think that someone finally called the authorities after he had passed out. It took hours for him to finally pass. Shame on all those folks who didn't try to do something to help him out during his ordeal.
When I read this, I wondered, Michael, you know, how I might have reacted. And I'm assuming that I probably would have first thought that it was a hoax of some kind or somebody just doing something maybe to get their attention. But if I felt that it was serious, I wondered what I would do. What would you do? What would you have done if you had seen this, if you had been online at the time of this?
Well, let me just say first that the Internet is a microcosm of the larger world. And I think that's important to know because there are, you know, these kinds of communities have always existed in the pre-internet era. Some of them are famously known as Jonestown, Guyana, among other kinds of circumstances. Now, in terms of what I would have done, you know, I think I would have done what I would do if I saw somebody try to do this on the street, and that is to try to stop them. You know, mm-hmm. It just seems to me that's, you know, that's the humane thing to do, to try to assist someone that is in need. But there's another part to this too, though, Tony, and that is, it's quite likely that certain kinds of folks are attracted to certain kinds of message boards, and that those of us who are interested in trying to help others in need may not necessarily find ourselves on a message board like this.
It's an interesting point, Carmen. Is there any responsibility that the people who control these sites have in a situation like this, do you think?
Only as far as one human being to another. I don't know what you mean quite by control the sites, but if I'm the administrator and I have a social network that people and that I'm not monitoring 24/7, then there are adults on the site. I allow them to interact as they will, as long as they don't do anything illegal, like, you know, share child porn or something like that. Mm-hmm. I would just think if I had been alerted or if I had been watching, at least I would have reached out to the young man and offered him comfort and not egged him on. But I really don't know the specifics enough
of that particular case. Well, let's not end the day before Thanksgiving on such a sober note. Let's talk about how the blog is being used in more positive ways. Is there something that you can think of, either of you, that is uplifting with regard to how people are interacting during this holiday time? I see Karma's looking around trying to think.
I've seen a lot of folks doing like fundraisers. Like there's some Twitter page that's doing fundraisers. There's a local pastor here. His name is Sean King. He's starting a church called Courageous, and he's raising school uniforms for a school that's in need here in Atlanta. So I think that there's a lot of goodwill that's being fostered via the internet and via the online community, folks who blog and folks who really show that they care about their fellow man, especially when we're looking at the economy. You know, more folks are going hungry this Thanksgiving. I think folks are thinking about their neighbor during this time of the year.
And I would add quickly, you know, in addition to everything that Imani just said, you know, the internet is a great place to do professional networking. And there are a lot of people who are losing their jobs right now. And we can communicate and transfer information from one to another to help people out who might be in need.
That's an interesting point. Carmen?
I just wanted to say that the idea that each of us as bloggers have a community that grows, that we sort of find ourselves in the middle of, which is the good news. And we have the ability to raise awareness of things that we see. And our community has the ability to send us emails and say, listen, would you post about this, to spread the word. So awareness comes before action, I think. Mm-hmm. So that's how, you know, at least at my spot, it's all about race. I get to call attention and call action to issues and charities and all sorts of things that we need to move on.
Really quickly, do you think that activity in terms of blogging, Carmen, is going to increase, decrease on the actual Thanksgiving day tomorrow? Is it going to be busier or will everyone be eating and nobody's going to be blogging?
I think it's going to decrease. That's my hunch. Decrease on Thanksgiving.
Okay.
We go offline to eat.
Yeah, listen, it's already probably decreased for me. So this is a week where I kind of take a pause, think about all the things I have to be thankful for, including my little son, Devin, who was born 3 weeks ago.
Oh, that's what we heard about that. So congratulations.
Congratulations.
Listen, thank you so much. We have been talking with writer Imani Channel, who blogs at My Urban Report, The New Dad. He was at Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Michael Fontroy, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. He blogs at michaelfontroy.com and was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C., and media consultant Carmen Dixon, who writes the blog All About Race. She also blogs for AOL Black Voices. Once again, happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
And happy Thanksgiving to you.
Last week, NPR's Farai Today, I had a freewheeling conversation with the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. They talked holiday cuisine, health, and Christmas music. Believe it or not, the Queen of Soul has never cut a Christmas album until now. This Christmas, Aretha features classic and contemporary songs infused with her trademark R&B, soul, and gospel styles. When we first ran Farai's chat with Aretha, it got such huge response that we decided that Thanksgiving Eve would be a good time to play it again. And so, here's the encore.
Christmas is so special for so many reasons. Each time it comes around, you hear very, very little on me. I'm not in the mix. And it's such a special time, as I said. But, you know, get the picture. The snow is softly falling. You've got a nice warm fire going. Maybe you're holding hands with your sweetie next to the fire. Or maybe you got a lot of good pots on the stove in the kitchen and all of that. You know, the good smells are wafting through the house and the bells ringing. People are gift-giving and the music is going and there's nothing on Aretha. Please, I gotta record some Christmas music.
So what's your favorite song on this? I mean,
favorite song, the whole album is my favorite. But my really, really, really favorite one is The Lord Will Make a Way. And Angels We Have Heard on High.
Yeah.
All right, couple other things. You were named number one vocalist of the rock era by Rolling Stone magazine.
I heard that.
How does that make you feel?
Oh, please. If I'm not careful, I might not be able to get out the doorway. My head might get caught in the doorway. It's a tremendous honor. It really is. And I am most appreciative for it.
It sounds like you don't, but do you ever get blasé about all the things that you've done and all the times people tell you that they love your work and that kind of appreciation, either from critics or from fans?
Oh, absolutely not. It's that's a good thing, and I'm delighted to hear it all the time. It's when you don't hear it, there's a problem. So I'm delighted to hear it all the time. It's a continuing acknowledgement of my work, and that means an awful lot to me.
I admit that I'm a huge holiday fan, and I come from a family with a lot of serious traditions and also people who are serious cooks.
Yes,
and you
so am I.
Are a serious cook, and
on this
album, you have this whole conversation about your holiday cooking, and you talk about how the chitlins almost killed you, so you weren't making them again. Now, do you mean health-wise you're not going to make chitlins anymore?
No, chitlins are out, and they are off the menu, and anything like chitlins for me. A, they were keeping my weight up, and B, they run your pressure up and things like that. So chitlins have been canceled off of my list, and I know my fans and friends are screaming hallelujah.
Well, you know, folks want you around for a long time. And
I want to be around for a long time, Farai. So let's drop the chitlins.
Since we know what's off the list, the chitlins are off the list, you have to give us a list of two or three things you think you're going to make as a cook over the holiday season.
Okay. Two or three things I'm going to make: baked chicken and dressing for sure. I'm going to do mixed greens, turnips and mustards. I'm going to do an ambrosia the way my grandmother used to make it. And let's see, mac and cheese for sure. And you said just a few things.
That's well, hey, this thing. I'm loving this.
Okay, that just sounds like Mickey D's. I'm loving it.
Well, look, the Queen of Soul thing could also apply to the Queen of Soul food thing, because when you told us last time that you had made oxtails while you were cooking on your bus, I was like, now that is a woman who has some dedication to cooking. Let me just ask, how do you make your greens? What do you put meat or no meat? And
actually, this time I'm going to use some smoked turkey. I hear that that is really, really wonderful. But after cleaning them, because, you know, greens are so gritty and so dirty, you have to clean them first, of course, before you put them on. One of the ladies from the church who took care of us when we were children taught me a long time ago, she said, just put a little bit of a teaspoon, maybe like a half a teaspoon of maybe soap powder in your greens, like something like Cheer. Or
Tide. You're kidding me.
I'm not kidding you. That's how dirty they are.
So just when you're rinsing them, I was like, you cannot put that in the pot.
When you're cooking them in the sink, just put that in there with it. And then, you know, you're working with it with your hands and everything and working that grit out of those greens. Listen, you won't believe how much dirt and grit comes out of those greens.
Okay,
and
so
all of that. And you rinse them so many times until they're just sparkling and can't be cleaner. And then I just, of course, put them on top of the ham hocks with some crushed red peppers and a little bit of garlic powder. I like that.
I think about the areas that you and I are from, Michigan and Maryland, and in some ways, right now we're going through these incredibly tough economic times, and it's not going to be a very comfortable holiday for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm, so, that's absolutely right.
I know that you do a lot of philanthropic work. How does the work that you do that we might not know so much about intersect with people's lives who are trying to just make a way out of no way?
I donate heavily to the church and various churches in the Detroit community and food banks. So that's just some of what I do.
Now, we've talked about food and health, but you may also be saving people's lives, because there's this new study out that says that listening to music produces endorphins that then lower your blood pressure.
Like laughter, right?
Exactly.
I can believe that. I absolutely believe that. Depends on what you're listening to. It's calming, it's soothing. You know, they say music soothes the savage beast, right?
Absolutely.
But music can do a lot of things. It transcends a lot of barriers.
What are you looking forward to?
Well, I think I'm going to be at the House of Blues for a very special performance for them.
Hmm.
And I am waiting for a rewrite on the script for my autobiography and just getting ready for the holidays.
Well, Aretha Franklin, it is always great to talk to you and have our wide-ranging conversations. So if I don't personally get to see you over the holiday season, I wish the best to you and yours.
Okay, Farai, same to you.
That was Aretha Franklin talking with NPR's Farai today about her new holiday album, This Christmas, Aretha.
Oh, my food is burning. I'll call you back.